The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Hello, this is Fred Woodward from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine, the best of U.S. and international media each week. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's reading of The Week magazine. This program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. And we are in our second week of reading the year-end edition of The Week magazine. It was dated December 31st, 2013. And we'll start this week with the big scientific breakthroughs of 2013. A galaxy teeming with Earths. Astronomers calculated that there are 11 billion possibly habitable planets in our galaxy, greatly upping the odds that we're not alone in the universe. Researchers used 4 years of data from NASA's orbiting Kepler telescope to compute how many planets lie in their solar system's Goldilocks zone, where surface temperatures support liquid water. They found that 1 in 5 sun-like stars harbors a roughly Earth-sized planet in the habitable zone, and the nearest may be only 12 light-years away, possibly close enough for communication. Given the sheer number of candidate planets, says astronomer Jeffrey Marcy, surely some of them have all the necessary attributes of life. The world's longest canyon. Geologists located the Earth's longest canyon beneath a 2-mile-thick plate of ice in Greenland. The huge gash in the island's bedrock, discovered by ice-penetrating radar, is twice as long and twice as wide as the Grand Canyon, though only about half as deep. It's not every five decades that you discover something quite as substantial and extensive as a feature like this, said geographer Jonathan Bamber of the University of Bristol in the UK. New organs through cloning. Cloning was used for the first time to create human embryonic stem cells, advancing the prospect of growing new organs from a patient's own tissue. Scientists inserted a skin cell from an 8-month-old baby into an unfertilized human egg that had had its own DNA removed. The cells fused and began to reproduce, yielding embryonic stem cells genetically identical to the baby's. These were then extracted and transformed into various cell lines and tissues, including beating human heart cells, said lead researcher Sukrat Mitalipov. The method could someday yield genetically matched replacement livers, kidneys, hearts, and other body parts for the seriously ill. A skull recasts prehistory. An almost intact 1.8 million-year-old skull found in the Republic of Georgia offered stunning evidence that early human evolution may have been simpler than previously thought. The oldest complete skull of an adult early Homo ever uncovered, it has a combination of attributes, a long face, large teeth, and tiny brain case, long considered earmarks of different hominids. Had the parts been found separately at different sites in Africa, they might have been attributed to different species, said University of Zurich paleoanthropologist Christopher Zollicoffer. Instead, the skull suggests that specimens previously identified as Homo ergaster, Homo rudolfensis, and Homo habilis are all part of a single Homo species that spread through Africa before migrating to Eurasia. Drastic climate change. An analysis of isotopes in marine fossils from around the world yielded the most complete record of Earth's temperature yet, and showed that the planet is heating up at a rate unprecedented in the past 11,300 years. Scientists say that if it weren't for greenhouse gas emissions, a cooling trend that began 5,000 years ago after a shift in the planet's orbit and angle would likely be continuing, advancing Earth toward another ice age. Instead, global warming at its current pace will heat the planet between 2 and 12 degrees further by 2100, challenging many species' ability to adapt. The climate changes to come, says NASA climate researcher Gavin Schmidt, are going to be larger than anything that human civilization has seen in its entire existence. As we noted last week, this year-end edition has three of the longer articles that we usually call the last word in it. We read one of them last week, and here's the second of the three. Great Reads from 2013. Artificial Emotions. Scientists studying human feelings, said Neil Savage, may soon be able to program robots to have them. When Angelica Lim bakes macaroons, she has her own kitchen helper, Naoki. Her assistant is only good at the repetitive tasks, like sifting flour, but he makes the job more fun. Naoki is very cute, just under 2 feet tall. He's white, mostly with blue headlights, and has speakers where his ears should be. The little round circle of a mouth that gives him a surprised expression is actually a camera, and his eyes are infrared receivers and transmitters. I just love robots, says Lim, a PhD student in the Department of Intelligent Science and Technology at Kyoto University in Japan. She uses Naoki to explore how robots might express emotions and interact with people. When Lim plays the flute, Naoki, the Japanese characters of his name translate roughly to more than a machine, accompanies her on the theremin or the egg shaker. She believes it won't be too many years before robotic companions share our homes and our lives. Of course, Naoki doesn't get the jokes, or enjoy the music, or feel his mouth watering over the cookies. Though we might refer to a person-shaped robot as him, we know it's just a collection of metal parts and circuit boards. When we yell at Siri or swear at our desktop, we don't really believe they're being deliberately obtuse, and they're certainly not going to react to our frustration. Machines don't understand what we feel. At least that's what we'd like to believe. Having feelings, we usually assume, and the ability to read emotions in others are human traits. We don't expect machines to know what we're thinking or react to our moods, and we feel superior to them because we emote and they don't. No matter how quick and logical they are, sensitive humans win and prevail over machines. Emotional David Bowman beats calculative HAL 9000 in 2001, A Space Odyssey, and desperate Sarah Connor triumphs over the ultimate killing machine in The Terminator. From Dr. McCoy condemning the unemotional Spock as a green-blooded inhuman in Star Trek, to moral reasoning that revolves around the unemotionality of criminals, we hold our emotions at the core of our identity. Special and indecipherable, except by us, our whims and fancies are what make us human. But we may be wrong in our thinking. Far from being some inexplicable, ethereal quality of humanity, emotions may be nothing more than an autonomic response to changes in our environment, software programmed into our biological hardware by evolution as a survival response. Neuroscientist Joseph Ledoux describes emotion in terms of survival circuits that exist in all living things. An organism, as simple as an amoeba or as complex as a person, reacts to an environmental stimulus in a way that makes it more likely to survive and reproduce. The stimulus flips switches on survival circuits which prompt behaviors that enhance survival. Neurons firing in a particular pattern might trigger the brain to order the release of adrenaline, which makes the heart beat faster, priming an animal to fight or flee from danger. That physical state, Ledoux says, is an emotion. Melissa Sturge Apple, a professor of psychology, agrees that emotions have something to do with our survival. They're kind of a response to environmental cues, and that organizes your actions, she says. If you're fearful, you might run away. If you get pleasure from eating something, you might eat more of it. You do things that facilitate your survival. And key among the human survival toolkit is communication, something emotions help facilitate through the use of empathy. By this reasoning, every living thing interested in survival emotes in some form, though perhaps not in quite the same way as humans. Certainly any pet owner will tell you that dogs experience emotions. The things we call feelings are our conscious interpretation and description of those emotional states, Ledoux argues. Other types of feelings, such as guilt, envy, or pride, are what he calls higher-order social emotions. We are also beginning to understand that the mechanics of how we express emotions are deeply tied to the emotion itself. Oftentimes, they determine what we are feeling. Smiling makes you happier, even if it's because Botox has frozen your face into an unholy imitation, says Eric Finzi in The Face of Emotion. Conversely, people whose facial muscles are immobilized by Botox injections can't mirror other people's expressions and have less empathy. No mechanics, no emotions, it seems. But if our emotional states are indeed mechanical, they can be detected and measured, which is what scientists in the field of affective computing are working on. They're hoping to enable machines to read a person's affect the same way we display and detect our feelings. By capturing clues from our voices, our faces, even the way we walk. Computer scientists and psychologists are training machines to recognize and respond to human emotion. They're trying to break down feelings into quantifiable properties with mechanisms that can be described and quantities that can be measured and analyzed. They're working on algorithms that will alert therapists when a patient is trying to hide his real feelings and computers that can sense and respond to our moods. Some are breaking down emotion into mathematical formalism that can be programmed into robots, because machines motivated by fear or joy or desire might make better decisions and accomplish their goals more efficiently. Wendy Heinzelman, a professor of electrical and computer engineering, is developing an algorithm to detect emotion based on vocal qualities of a speaker. Heinzelman feeds a computer speech samples recorded by actors attempting to convey particular feelings, and tells the computer which clips sound happy, sad, angry, and so on. The computer measures the pitch, energy, and loudness of the recordings, as well as the fluctuations in energy and pitch from one moment to the next. More fluctuations can suggest a more active emotional state, such as happiness or fear. The computer also tracks what are known as formants, a band of fundamental frequencies that are affected by the shape of the vocal tract. If your throat tightens because you're angry, it alters your voice, and the computer can measure that. With these data, it can run a statistical analysis to figure out what distinguishes one emotion from another. With emotions reduced to their components, recorded and analyzed, it becomes possible to input them into machines. The value of this project might seem simple. The resulting robots will have richer, more interesting, and more fun interactions with humans. Lim hopes that, in the future, how Naoki moves and how it plays, the theremin, will allow it to express its emotional states. But there are also deeper reasons why engineers are interested in emotional robots. If emotionals help living things survive, will they do the same for robots? An intelligent agent, a robot or piece of software that could experience emotions in response to its environment, could make quick decisions, like a human dropping everything and fleeing when he sees his house is on fire. Emotions focus your attention, says Mehdi Dastani, a professor of computer science. Your focus gets changed from what you're working on to a much more important goal, like saving your life. Dastani is providing intelligent agents with what he calls a logic of emotion, a formalized description of 22 different emotional states such as pity, gloating, resentment, pride, admiration, gratitude, and others. A robot can use them, he explains, to evaluate progress it's making toward a goal. An unemotional robot, directed to go from point A to point B, might hit an obstacle in its path and simply keep banging into it. An intelligent agent equipped with emotion might feel sad at its lack of progress and eventually give up and go do something else. The robot's emotions offer a kind of problem-solving strategy computer scientists call a heuristic, which is the ability to discover and learn things for itself, like humans do. But could a machine actually have emotions? Arvid Kappas, a professor of psychology, believes that it comes back to the definition of emotion. By some definitions, even a human baby, which operates mostly on instinct and doesn't have the cognitive capacity to understand or describe its feelings, might be said to have no emotions. By other definitions, the trait exists in all sorts of animals, with most people willing to ascribe feelings to creatures that closely resemble humans. So does he believe a computer could be emotional? As emotional as a crocodile, sure. As emotional as a fish, yes. As emotional as a dog, I can see that. But would robots that felt feel the same we do, the same way we do? They would probably be machine emotions, not human emotions, because they have machine bodies, said Kappas. Emotions are tied into our sense of ourselves as physical beings. A robot might have such a sense, but it would be of a very different self, with no heart and a battery meter instead of a stomach. An android in power-saving mode may, in fact, dream of electric sheep, and that starts to raise ethical questions. What responsibility does a human have when the Roomba begs not to let its battery die? What do you say to robot Charlie when the Charlie S6 comes out and you want to send the old model to the recycling plant? It really is important, if human beings are going to be interacting with robots, to think about whether robots could be feeling and under what conditions, says Bruce McLennan, a professor of computer science. McLennan feels that this isn't just a philosophical question, but one that can be tackled scientifically. He proposes trying to break emotions down into what he calls proto-phenomena, the tiniest units of the physical effects that lead to emotion. Proto-phenomena are so small that they're not normally something a person would be aware of as part of their conscious experience, he says. There should be some basic physical quantities that science can measure and, therefore, reproduce in machines. I think anything that's going to be able to make the kinds of decisions we want a human-scale android to make, they're going to inevitably have consciousness, McLennan says. And, Ledoux argues, since human consciousness drives our experience of emotion, that could give rise to robots actually experiencing feelings. It will probably be many decades before we're forced to confront questions of whether robots can have emotions comparable to human ones, says McLennan. I don't think they're immediate questions that need to be answered, but they do illuminate our understanding of ourselves, so they're good to address. coexisting with emotional robots, he argues, could have as profound an effect as one civilization meeting another, or as humanity making contact with extraterrestrial intelligence. We would be forced to face the question of whether there's anything so special about our feelings, and if not, whether there's anything special about us at all. It would maybe focus us more on what makes humans human, he says, to be confronted by something that is so like us in some ways, but in other ways is totally alien. This article was taken from Nautilus at www.nautil.us. The last of our great reads from 2013 is titled The Chaos on Everest. The tallest mountain is full of dead bodies, garbage, and amateurs, said Mark Jenkins. Can Everest be saved? An hour above High Camp on the southeast ridge of Everest, Panuru Sherpa and I passed the first body. The dead climber was on his side, his head half covered by the hood of his parka, goose down blowing from holes torn in his insulated pants. 10 minutes later, we stepped around another body, her torso shrouded in a Canadian flag, an abandoned oxygen bottle holding down the flapping fabric. Trudging nose to butt up the ropes that had been fixed to the steep slope, Panuru and I were wedged between strangers above us and below us. The day before, at Camp 3, our team had been part of a small group. But when we woke up this morning, we were stunned to see an endless line of climbers passing near our tents. Now, bumper to bumper at 27,000 feet, we were forced to move at exactly the same speed as everyone else, regardless of strength or ability. In the swirling darkness before midnight, I gazed up at the string of lights, climbers' headlamps rising into the black sky. Above me were more than 100 slow-moving climbers. In one rocky section, at least 20 people were attached to a single ratty rope anchored by a single badly bent picket pounded into the ice. If the picket popped, the rope or carabiner would instantly snap from the weight of 24 fallen climbers, and they would all cartwheel down the face to their death. Panuru, the lead Sherpa of our team, and I, unclipped from the lines, swerved out into the open ice and began soloing. For experienced mountaineers, a safer option. 20 minutes later, another corpse. Still attached to the line of ropes, he was sitting in the snow, frozen solid as stone, his face black, his eyes wide open. Several hours later, before the Hillary Step, a 40-foot wall of rock and the last obstacle before the summit, we passed yet another corpse. His stubbly face was gray, his mouth open as if moaning from the pain of death. Exactly why these individuals died still wasn't clear. However, many recent deaths on Everest have been attributed to a dangerous lack of experience. Without enough training at high altitude, some climbers are unable to judge their own stamina and don't know when to turn around and call it quits. Only half the people here have the experience to climb this mountain, Panuru told me. The half without experience are the most likely to die. Too often, it's not the mountain's harshness that kills climbers, but their own hubris. How different it was 50 years ago when, on May 1, 1963, James Whittaker, accompanied only by Sherpa Nawang Gombu, became the first American to reach the summit of the world. Big Jim did it by climbing the southeast ridge, the same route pioneered in 1953 by the peerless New Zealander Edmund Hillary and Sherpa Tenzing Norgay. Whitaker had climbed Mount McKinley a few years before, and it was Gombu's third trip to Everest. 3 weeks after Whitaker and Gombu's ascent, in an unprecedented act of boldness, teammates Tom Hornbein and Willie Unsold clawed their way up a completely new route, the West Ridge. On that same day, Barry Bishop and Lute Gerstadt made the second American ascent of the Southeast Ridge. The two teams managed to meet below the summit, but by then it was dark, and they were forced to bivouac at 28,000 feet, a risky last-ditch option never before attempted. Without tents, sleeping bags, stoves, Sherpas, oxygen, water, or food, they weren't expected to survive. "God, they were lucky," says Whitaker. "If there had been any wind, they would have all perished. It would have been horrible." All four men lived, although Unsold and Bishop lost 19 toes between them. The 1963 American expedition became a tale of heroic success, the moonshot of mountaineering. Our team was on Everest to mark the anniversary of that expedition. Yet as we witnessed, the mountain has become an icon for everything that is wrong with climbing. Unlike in 1963, when only six people reached the top, in the spring of 2012, more than 500 mobbed the summit. When I arrived at the apex on May 25th, it was so crowded I couldn't find a place to stand. Meanwhile, down below at the Hillary Step, the lines were so long that some people going up waited more than 2 hours, shivering, growing weak, this even though the weather was excellent. If these throngs of climbers had been caught in a storm, as others were in 1996, the death toll could have been staggering. Everest has always been a trophy, but now that almost 4,000 people have reached its summit, the feat means less than it did half a century ago. Today, roughly 90% of the climbers on Everest are guided clients, many without basic climbing skills. Having paid $30,000 to $120,000 to be on the mountain, too many callously expect to reach the summit. A significant number do, but under appalling conditions. The two standard routes, the Northeast Ridge and the Southeast Ridge, are not only dangerously crowded, but also disgustingly polluted, with garbage leaking out of the glaciers and pyramids of human excrement befouling the high camps. And then there are the deaths. Beside the four climbers who perished on the Southeast Ridge, six others lost their lives in 2012, including three Sherpas. Clearly, the world's highest peak is broken. But if you talk to the people who know it best, they'll tell you it's not beyond repair. Russell Bryce runs Himalayan Experience, the largest and most sophisticated guiding operation on Everest. Himex, as it's known, has led 17 expeditions to Everest. Every climber and Sherpa on a Himex team is issued a radio and is required to check in every day. Each is also required to wear an avalanche transceiver, a helmet, a harness, and crampons, and to attach themselves to safety lines. During the spring 2012 season, a Sherpa from another team failed to clip the safety lines and fell to his death in a crevasse. To avoid getting into trouble, clients must keep pace or turn around. Despite the relatively large size of Bryce's teams, as many as 30 clients matched with 30 Sherpas, they leave a small footprint on the mountain, removing all of their excrement and rubbish, a practice not followed by most teams. Cleanup efforts by the Sagarmatha Pollution Control Committee, a sort of Everest City Council, have improved conditions at base camp, but they haven't had much impact higher up on the mountain. Camp 2, at 21,240 feet, is particularly disgusting. Camp 4 is a little better, the tattered skeletons of abandoned tents snapping in the wind. We can manage the numbers of all the operators if all the operators talk to each other, Bryce insists. It's all about good communication. If only it were that simple. There are other factors at work. One, ironically, is improved weather forecasting. Lack of information once led expeditions to attempt the summit whenever their team members were ready. Today, with hyper-accurate satellite forecasts, all teams know exactly when a weather window will open up, and they often go for the top on the same days. Another factor, low-budget outfitters don't always have the staff, knowledge, or proper equipment to keep their clients safe if something goes wrong. The cheaper operators often employ fewer Sherpas, and those they do hire sometimes lack experience. All of the clients who died on Everest this past year went with low-budget, less experienced operators, said Willie Benegas, a high-altitude guide and co-owner of Benegas Brothers Expeditions, which has led 11 trips to Everest. To prevent crowding on the mountain, some have proposed limiting not only the total number of permits per season, but also the size of each team, to no more than 10 clients per team. Others are skeptical. That will not happen, says Guy Cotter, owner of Adventure Consultants. Everest is big business for Nepal, and they will never turn down the money. Everest also needs a permanent search and rescue team. 8 Sherpas and 4 Western guides, all paid through the ministry, says Conrad Anker, who led the National Geographic-supported expedition in 2012. This would make the mountain safer. A decade ago, Anker and his wife founded the Khumbu Climbing Center in the village of Fortsi to improve the mountaineering skills of Sherpas and thereby increase the safety margin for everyone on Everest. Many of the center's 700-plus graduates are now working for outfitters on the mountain. The Sherpas, after all, are the ones who perform most of the rescues. Danuru Sherpa, a KCC graduate, told me he has dragged at least 5 people off the mountain to save their lives. One of the obvious problems is that clients don't respect the knowledge and experience of Sherpas, Anker said. The Sherpas are, in a way, partly to blame. Most of them are Tibetan Buddhists whose culture and religious principles discourage confrontation. Clients sometimes disregard their advice and die, Anker said. Last year was a case in point. We're trying to help the Sherpas become more assertive. Modern technology, which is already ubiquitous on Everest, everyone at base camp has access to a cell phone or the internet, could also make the mountain safer. Last summer, Anker proposed something new: identification cards issued with every climbing permit. The Everest ID would contain data that could save the life of a climber or Sherpa, Anker explains. It would have the climber's photo, of course, but more important, a QR code. Scanned with a smartphone by an Everest climbing ranger, the QR code would reveal all pertinent information: age, experience, health history, allergies, insurance, family, emergency phone numbers, everything. Despite all the problems on the mountain, Everest still stands alone. There will always be people who want to climb the world's tallest peak, because there's no more to being on Everest than getting hemmed in by crowds or confronted by heaps of trash. The mountain is so high and so indifferent, it calls upon every climber at one time or another to rise to his or her better self. There is also beauty on Everest. I'll never forget the breathtaking view from our perch at Camp 3. Clouds roiling up the western CWM like the slow-motion reverse avalanche. Or the visceral relief of a cup of scalding soup at Camp 4. Or the crunch of my crampons in the crystalline labyrinth of the Khumbu Icefell just above the base camp. I'll treasure the memory of climbing with friends on the mountain. I committed my life to them, and they committed their lives to me. Such moments are the reasons climbers keep coming back to Everest. It's not simply about reaching the summit, but about showing respect for the mountain and enjoying the journey. Now it's up to us to restore a sense of sanity to the top of the world. This article comes to us from Mark Jenkins at National Geographic Creative. Back in the health and science section, we have the summary split into two sections. Some of the things they said were good for us, and some of the things we were told to avoid. They said Tylenol was good for us. Tylenol can help calm existential dread. To get volunteers to mull their inevitable death, researchers at the University of British Columbia had them watch scenes from the disturbing David Lynch film Rabbits, or write about what they thought would happen to their bodies when they died. Those who were given Tylenol beforehand were significantly less upset by such depressing activities than those given a placebo. The medicine's main ingredient, acetaminophen, seems to ease angst, said study author Daniel Randles, because a similar neurological process is responsible for physical pain and emotional duress. They said sunscreen was good for us. Sunscreen can protect us against wrinkles. Australian researchers found that fair-skinned volunteers who applied SPF 15 lotion to their head, neck, and arms and hands every morning for 4.5 years showed 24% fewer signs of aging than those who had not. The benefits were the same for middle-aged participants, those with moderate skin damage, and those with younger-looking skin, because ultraviolet rays damage the collagen that gives the skin its plump, youthful appearance. It makes sense that blocking those rays would slow skin's aging. If you don't need a flashlight to see outside, you need protection, said dermatologist Doris Day. They said reading fiction was good for us. It makes you nicer, more empathetic person. Psychologists at the New School for Social Research in New York City asked people between the ages of 18 and 75 to read an excerpt of literary fiction or popular fiction or a nonfiction article, and then tested their ability to gauge the emotions of people by looking at pictures of their faces. The subjects who read literary works scored much higher on the test than the other readers. Study author Emmanuel Castano says that's likely because literary fiction takes readers into other lives and forces them to reconstruct the mind of the character, an ability that carries over into real social situations. And they also said nostalgia was good for us. It can ward off loneliness and anxiety. Though often triggered by isolation and challenging life changes, it offers relief by bringing to mind cherished experiences that assure us we are valued people who have meaningful lives, said psychologist Clay Routledge of North Dakota State University. Such reminiscences are remarkably similar across cultures, centering on being with friends at weddings, holidays, and other special moments. The ability to call up a fond memory to maintain psychological comfort may even be an evolutionary adaptation. And some of the things we were told to avoid? Guess what? Tylenol. Tylenol can send you to the hospital. An investigative report found that its active ingredient, acetaminophen, is the country's leading cause of acute liver failure. Some 78,000 Americans visit the ER each year following an overdose, and roughly 150 Americans die from it. The key issue is the narrow margin of error in dosage, said report author T. Christian Miller. While acetaminophen is safe at recommended doses, Exceeding them over time, even by 2 extra strength Tylenol tablets a day, can be risky, especially if it's mixed with alcohol. Infant and children's Tylenol can be especially risky when administered incorrectly. We were told to avoid energy drinks, as they can send you to the hospital too. More than 20,000 people went to the ER in 2011 with anxiety, rapid heartbeats, seizures, or heart attacks after downing the highly caffeinated beverages, more than twice the number from 4 years earlier. More than half the patients had negative reactions to the drinks alone, which included Monster, Red Bull, and Rockstar, while others experienced trouble after combining them with alcohol or prescription drugs, such as the stimulants Adderall and Ritalin. People don't realize the strength of these things, says a spokesman for the American College of Emergency Physicians. We were told to avoid too little salt. It can cause stress to the heart. Though the American Heart Association recommends 1,500 milligrams per day or less, a new report found that reducing sodium intake below 2,300 milligrams can increase a person's risk of heart problems. In study of patients with congestive heart failure, those who consumed 1,800 milligrams of sodium daily were twice as likely to die during the study period as patients who took in 2,700 milligrams. Salt is known to raise blood pressure, but researchers now see its role as more complicated, says researcher Michael H. Alderman of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. And finally, you guessed it, they told us to avoid too much salt. Too much salt can contribute to autoimmune disease. Researchers noticed that frequent fast food eaters had above normal levels of Th17 cells, which attack the body's own tissues in diseases such as multiple sclerosis, rheumatoid arthritis, and type 1 diabetes. When they tested salt's effect on the immune cells of mice, they found that the more the animals were exposed to it, the more Th17 cells they produced. Feeding a high-salt diet to mice genetically engineered to develop NS rapidly accelerated the course of the disease. If I had an autoimmune disease, says Yale immunobiologist David Hafler, I would put myself on a low-salt diet now. In the review of reviews on books, last week I gave you the top fiction pick, 10th of December by George Saunders, and the top nonfiction pick, Going Clear by Lawrence Wright, but I didn't tell you how they came up with their list, how the books were chosen. Our rankings were created by weighting end-of-year recommendations published by AV Club, ChicagoTribune.com, CSMonitor.com, Entertainment Weekly, the Kansas City Star, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, Newsday, New York Magazine, the New York Times, O Magazine, Slate.com, Time, USA Today, the Wall Street Journal, and the Washington Post. So we did indeed get a review of reviews, and we probably don't have time for all of them, but let me pick another fiction and a nonfiction. The number 5 selection from fiction is called The Sun by Philip Meyer. With only his second novel, Philip Meyer delivered a Texas epic that can stand alongside classics by Larry McMurtry and Cormac McCarthy, said Yvonne Zipp in CSMonitor.com. A family saga that spans 4 generations, The Sun opens with high drama as 13-year-old Eli McCullough is kidnapped and orphaned during an 1849 Comanche raid. Eli will blossom into a Comanche warrior, then a Texas Ranger who builds a cattle and oil empire. But his descendants' stories share the stage, and Meyer cuts masterfully across eras from the start. when Eli's son agonizes over the racism that helped build the family fortune, and Eli's great-granddaughter battles through sexism to take control of the business, their stories feel nearly as compelling as Eli's, said Ken Tucker in thedailybeast.com. The Sun is a book of ideas, but it's also a book packed with thrilling escapes and rescues, daring love affairs, and comic moments that slide without warning into chilling horrors. A dissenting voice said, all 600 pages of The Sun add up to little more than a none-too-subtle bashing of Texas history, myths, and legends, said Clay Reynolds in the Dallas Morning News. The number 5 title on the nonfiction side caught my eye. It's called The Unwinding by George Packer. To me, this 5th-place finisher is something close to a nonfiction masterpiece, said Dwight Garner in the New York Times. A sweeping portrait of contemporary American life, it begins like a horror novel, which in some regards it is. To George Packer, another New Yorker writer, the story of our time has been the erosion of middle-class institutions and the rise of a winner-take-all society created by organized money. The book proves to be more intimate and textured than most contemporary works of fiction, said Hector Tobar in the Los Angeles Times. The reader comes to know, among others, a venture capitalist, an Ohio factory worker, and a disillusioned former aide to Vice President Joe Biden. None are saints, none pure victims. What distinguishes The Unwinding is the fullness of Packer's portraits, his willingness to show his subjects' human desires and foibles, and to give each of his subjects a fully throated voice. They've been buffeted by storms, but they haven't abandoned hope. A dissenting voice, Packer prefers moping to thinking deeply about how to actually revitalize the U.S. job market, said The Economist. We have a section here called Farewell. It's basically a listing of notables who died during the year 2013. I won't read the entire list, but I'll give you a smattering from the different areas. Media and publishing, Pauline Phillips, also known as Dear Abby, age 94. Roger Ebert, the film critic, age 70. Dr. Joyce Brothers, age 85. Helen Thomas, longtime doyen of the White House Press Corps, age 92. Seamus Heaney, Nobel Prize-winning Irish poet, age 74. David Frost, British broadcaster who recorded interviews with Richard Nixon, age 74. Tom Clancy, age 66. Doris Lessing, Nobel Prize-winning author, age 94. From the stage and screen, Annette Funicello, one of the original Mouseketeers, age 70. Jonathan Winters, comedian extraordinaire, age 87. Jean Stapleton, actress who played Edith Bunker in All in the Family, age 90. James Gandolfi from The Sopranos, age 51. Paul Walker from the Fast and Furious series, age 40. Peter O'Toole of Lawrence of Arabia fame, age 81. From music and the arts, Van Cliburn, the American pianist who soared to fame by winning the International Tchaikovsky competition in Moscow, age 78. Country singer George Jones, 81. Lou Reed, groundbreaking rocker, age 71. In the political arena, former New York Mayor Ed Koch, aged 88. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, age 58. British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher, age 87. Tom Foley, former U.S. Representative and Speaker of the House, age 84. And of course, at the year end, Nelson Mandela. A few others from the general category. Stan Musial, one of the greatest hitters in baseball history, age 92. C. Everett Koop, the U.S. Surgeon General, who took a strong stand against smoking, age 96. Julius Chambers, civil rights lawyer, age 76. And Pat Summerall, sports broadcaster, age 82. If you are into current hit music, the Review of Reviews on Music gives us the number one single of the year as Get Lucky by the group Daft Punk. The biggest hit Daft Punk ever recorded is also as close to magic as pop comes, says Sasha Freira Jones in The New Yorker. Like the summer's other ubiquitous song, Robin Thicke's Blurred Lines, it harked back to 1970s disco as Daft Punk even enlisted Nile Rodgers to provide the airy, sparkling rhythm guitar figure at the track's core. Lead vocalist Pharrell Williams doesn't have a virtuoso's pipes, but his silky smooth alto is wonderfully unpretentious and the perfect complement to that immaculate guitar. The number two, Royals by Lorde, L-O-R-D-E. The production is spare and haunting, and the vocals are simultaneously vulnerable and imperious, said Duncan Grieve in The Guardian. But the words made this song a phenomenon, as its 16-year-old singer-songwriter pushed back against global consumer culture by insisting that there are paths to joy that don't involve Maybachs and Cristal champagne. The New Zealand teen wasn't rejecting pop music itself, but the song's success owed partly to its shape-shifting ability to reflect the assumptions of the listener. And the third of the top three is New Slaves by Kanye West. The standout single from West's latest was a showstopper in its stunning starkness, said Andrew Unterberger in PopDust.com. An eerie plink-plonking synth riff and a threatening bass rumble provide virtually the entire backdrop as the rapper unleashes a blistering rant about racism, luxury culture, and the prison industrial complex. We're given no choice but to listen to every word, and he spits out rhymes as if this might be the most important rap of his 10-year career. In truth, it very well might be. We'll pick up a couple more book reviews on the way out here. The number three on the fiction side is called The Flamethrowers by Rachel Kushner. Rachel Kushner's second novel plays with ideas the way someone might juggle Molotov cocktails, said Mindy Farabee in the San Francisco Chronicle. Reno, a 22-year-old artist and motorcycle racer, stars in this globe-spanning zip through the tumult of the 1970s, and her bid to carve herself a place in a couple of very macho realms roils with uneasy questions about freedom, power, and identity. Soon after breaking a land speed world record in Utah, Reno immerses herself in New York's art world, then follows a lover to Italy and falls in with a group of anarchists. The entire story has all the momentum of Reno on her motorcycle, but nothing here passes in a blur, says Catherine Schultz in New York Magazine. Kushner possesses astonishing observational powers, and no detour she takes feels superfluous. She seems to work with a muse and a nail gun. So surprisingly, yet forcefully, do her sentences pin reality to the page. A dissenting voice says, "The coherence of the writing slips slightly when the plot picks up speed," said James Wood at the New Yorker. A slight knock, I would say, but not much. And why not finish up with "It Must Be True," the best of the tabloids in 2013. A tiger briefly escaped from a Kansas circus and gave a patron quite a scare when it wandered into the ladies' room. Jenna Crable had just finished watching the big cat show and went into the bathroom, not knowing one of the cats had gotten away from its handlers. You don't expect to go into the bathroom door, have it shut behind you, and see a tiger walking towards you, Crable said. She quickly turned and left, and the tiger was returned to its cage. A British fisherman was arrested after stealing a sea bass from an aquarium to win a fishing tournament. Matthew Clark, 29, won a trophy and $1,300 in prize money for the 13-pound fish. But rival anglers quickly recognized the bass's distinctive markings from a local aquarium. He was reported and confessed and said he sold the prize winner to a fishmonger. All we got back was the head and the tail. And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Fred Woodward. The Triangle Radio Reading Service wishes to thank Charlie and Carolyn Kerr for their support of today's Reading of the Week magazine. The program honors Charlie's sister, Bonnie Cassidy, who continues to be a true inspiration to their family. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. The broadcast is available as a podcast right after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time.